we continue now with the ongoing tale of how Rav Baruch, the father of the Alter Rebbe, became a chassid. You'll recall that Rav Baruch is spending his last Pesach before his chasana, before his wedding, with Rabbi Yitzchok Scholl, and he's hearing stories about the development of chassidus. And on one of the stories, which was recently told, which had made a very great impression upon Rav Baruch and upon his the other individuals who heard it, and Rav Baruch felt that the approach of Chassidus had certainly proved itself to advantage in that particular instance, and now they were eager to hear more from Rabbi Yitzchok Scholl of the secret group of Chassidim in Harki and how they came to reveal themselves to the Jewish world. But before Yitzchok Scholl related his next story, the Smith's son, Shmuel Nochem, came out with a story from Dubrovna, at which yeshiva he had studied. It was a story like every other story told by and of Chassidim, which held a deeply moral lesson. "We are ready to listen, Shmuel Nochem," said Yitzchok Scholl, "for I know that these stories of Chassidic life are more than mere stories. They have the power to provoke deep thought, to stir one to tshuva, to repentance, and to make one aspire to maisim tovim, to great deeds." The story told this time by Shmuel Nochem was of a Polish, a hermit, who lived in Dubrovna and about whom the town was talking. When Shmuel Nochem first arrived in Dubrovna, he was examined and found not yet qualified to enter the yeshiva. And so, until such time as he reached the required standard, he studied under the guidance of a teacher at the Beis HaMedrash, known as the Shul of the Alta Porush, the synagogue of the old hermit. There, sure enough, he found Chaim the Porush. Chaim the hermit was then already a very old man. Shmuel Nochem heard that the old Porush had been studying at this Beis HaMedrash for the past 30 years, and naturally thought that this was why the Beis HaMedrash was named the Shul of the Old Hermit, the Old Porush. But to his surprise, he learned that the Beis HaMedrash bore this title even before the time of Chaim the Porush. And this is what Shmuel Nochem was told. He heard that about 80 to 90 years previously, there was a boy in Dubrovna whose name was Fivish Henoch, was a very God-fearing lad. Although he was no great student, he nevertheless devoted all his time, practically day and night, to reciting Tehillim, and he did this in the sweetest voice imaginable. Fivish Henoch was a beautiful-looking boy and of strong physique, and his voice was a pleasure to listen to. When he sang the Shir HaMalis, his voice rang with joy, so that everyone listening to him felt their beings permeated with feelings of joy and gladness. But when Fivish Henoch recited the Tehillim, which were outpourings of the soul to Hashem, beseeching him to help his troubled people, Fivish Henoch's voice assumed such depths of melancholy and distress that everyone felt full of sorrow and sadness, and many an eye was dewy with tears. Then, all at once, when Fivish Henoch became 16 years of age, he suddenly took it into his head to live apart from everyone and to live differently. He spent literally every moment of his life in the recitation of Tehillim. And in order that nothing or no one should deter him from his purpose, he stopped up his ears so that no sound of the outside world should reach him. He covered up his eyes that no sight should disturb him, and he could recite this Tehillim and prayers balpeb by heart. He ate hardly anything at all, fasting all day and only partaking of a crust of bread and a drink of water at nights. On Shabbos or Yontif, he ate white bread instead of the darker bread, and in addition drank a glass of wine. And thus he lived. One might have expected to see him become a physical wreck under the circumstances, but to everyone's surprise, he became, if anything, even stronger and more handsome. Thus he continued all his life. Naturally, such a person could not pass unnoticed anywhere, and he was talked about in and around Dubrovnik. Not far from this town, there was an estate owned by a certain Polish nobleman who was an anti-Semite, and of course, very cruel by nature. It took his fancy to have this much-talked-of hermit brought to his estate so that he and his friends could be entertained at his expense. And so he sent off a servant to bring him. When the servant approached Dubrovna, he heard that it was impossible to approach Fivishenich the hermit, for he was a holy man. When the servant heard this, he fled in terror and repeated what he had heard to his master. His master then flew into a rage and screamed at the servant that he would soon show him who was master and whether his wishes could be so lightly flouted. He ordered another servant to bring the hermit, and as a punishment, the previous servant would be publicly flogged. The Polish nobleman then sent a rider through the towns and villages to act as a town crier, as a PR man, inviting all and sundry to come and witness the public flogging of his serf, promising that later they would also have the pleasure of being entertained by the presence of Fivishenich the hermit. A public flogging was quite the recognized thing in those days, and so many non-Jews gathered at the appointed hour to watch the show. The whips were brought, made of twisted and plated leather straps, and a couple of strong official, as it were, whippers stood by in readiness for the calling out and counting of the lashes. The usual penalty in such cases was the administering of 15 lashes, and generally it took but 5 or so to bring long red wheels showing on the naked back of the unfortunate victim who shrieked in pain and fear as the blood spurted from his wounds. Then, more dead than alive, the victim, having received his full measure of punishment, was yet expected to crawl on all fours, kissing the feet of the nobleman and begging his forgiveness for his, as it were, sin. After which, the victim would be carried home, where he would lie in pain and suffering for several weeks until he would recover from his ordeal. But in this case, to the astonishment of all who beheld it, not even one mark showed on the back of the servant, and at the end of the 15 lashes, he crawled, as he was expected to do, to the feet of his chief, kissed his feet, begged his forgiveness, then rose to his feet and walked off, just as if nothing untoward had just occurred. Everyone wondered what would happen now, for it was known that the nobleman had sent other servants to bring along Fivishenich the hermit, and under no circumstances were they to fail in the carrying out of their mission. What, people wondered, would happen now? As the people stood waiting and wondering, the riders whom the nobleman had sent to bring the hermit appeared, but without the hermit. "What is the meaning of this?" thundered the squire. "Why have you dared to return without carrying out my orders?" The chief rider stepped forward, saying, "Please, your honor, allow me to explain what happened. We had every intention of doing your bidding. We made our way to the Beis HaMedrash, where we knew we would find the hermit. We entered and found him standing in the corner, wearing a talus and a black small leather box on his head, singing his prayers, oblivious to everyone around him. I called out to him, but he either did not hear me or he pretended not to hear me. So I stepped up to him and struck at him with my whip, but near as I was, it somehow did not seem to touch him. We stood there in fear and trembling, for we now had been warned by the Jews that he is a holy man, and now we saw it for ourselves. Nevertheless, because we wished to obey your wishes, we stood there for 3 hours trying to make him understand that he must come with us as you had commanded. We shouted, we even dared to curse him, but in the end, we found we were helpless against him, and so finally, we had no alternative but to return without him. The squire, who had been getting redder and redder with rage and embarrassment at being thus thwarted, now screamed, "Strip this wretch who dares to disobey me. This will show him who is master, and that when I give an order I will have it obeyed. 30 lashes, at once." This time no miracle helped the unfortunate man, who roared with pain as the whip lashed across his bare back. The wheels began to show immediately, and by the end of the counting, his back was a red mass of blood. They had to pour a bucket of cold water over him before he was able to crawl to the feet of his master, showing his servitude to him. Then, literally more dead than alive, he was carried home. "That settles him," shouted the squire, "but does not yet settle my account with the hermit. I shall get him here by hook or by crook. Saddle me a horse and get the trumpeter to assemble a regiment of cavalry and another of infantry, and we will show that hermit that we mean business. Also call the priest that he too may accompany us." For in his heart of hearts, there was a creeping fear that the hermit might after all be a supernatural being, and he felt that the priest's presence might help him against the Jew's magic powers. The squire's messengers dashed away to do their master's bidding. He must be obeyed at any time, but in his present mood, they dared refuse him nothing. When the priest appeared and heard what was expected of him, he tried to dissuade the squire from attempting to force the Jewish hermit to do anything against his will. "Please, your honor, do not do anything against Fivishenach the hermit. He is a holy man, and you will be wiser to leave him alone. As for me, I shall certainly have no hand in such dangerous foolishness." "Aren't you ashamed of being so superstitious regarding this crazy Jew?" said the squire. "I shall go without you and soon show you that he's just an ordinary human being, no more, excepting that he is mentally unhinged. He's meshuga. I shall bring him here myself. You'll see." When his regiments gathered together in military fashion, all prepared as if it were going out to battle, the squire set off at their head, and away they went on the road to Dubrovna in quest of the elusive hermit. Meanwhile, news had reached the Jews of Dubrovna of what was happening. The Rav and heads of the community called a hurried meeting and decided to warn all the Jews to keep their houses, to keep to their houses, and not dare even to look out of their windows. As for themselves, they quickly hurried off to the Beis HaMedrash so they should be there when the squire and his armed men arrived. When the squire walked into the Beis HaMedrash and found the Rav and the Jewish heads of the community there, the squire greeted them in a friendly manner, but gave them to understand that he was determined to show once and for all that this particular hermit who refused to see, hear, or eat was just crazy and had nothing supernatural about him. The Jews then begged him to reconsider and not attempt anything against this holy man. "You are playing with fire," they told him. But he refused to listen to their warnings and just laughed at them. "You will soon see that I shall make him see and hear and eat like anyone else. I will show you that my whip is stronger than this maniac. I have driven the nonsense out of many obstinate persons with this whip, and shall now drive the nonsense out of this individual as well." Saying which, the squire stepped up to Fivishenach the hermit and struck at him with his whip. The whip fell out of his grasp, and his hands dropped helplessly to his side as excruciating pains shot through his arms. Feivke, Feivke, he screamed to him, but the hermit continued with his singing and praying, just as if he had heard or seen nothing. There was an air of panic in the Beis HaMedrash. The Rav and his friends were afraid. Who knew what means of retaliation the squire would choose to take against their whole community? The squire's men, on their part, were terrified of what might happen to them if the squire ordered them to take any action against the hermit, for they were in no doubt whatsoever that he was truly a holy man. But their attention was called now to their master, who now began screaming with the pain in his right arm and hand, and so they quickly, and with a feeling of relief at their own escape, bundled him into the carriage they had brought for the hermit, for he was beyond riding on horseback, and off they set for home. During the whole proceedings, Feivish Henoch the hermit took absolutely no notice of what went on around him. And the music of his voice filled the Beis HaMedrash. Meanwhile, the squire's pain went from bad to worse. Becoming desperate, he expressed his willingness to be carried back to the hermit to beg his forgiveness, for he realized that he had been punished for attempting to strike him. But the squire was told that no one could approach the holy man to make himself heard, and so he realized that he could expect no help or relief from his agonizing pains from that quarter. He summoned the best doctors, but their unanimous verdict was that his right arm must be operated upon and removed, otherwise his whole body would be poisoned. When this story got around, it was everywhere agreed, even where before there might have been some doubters, that Feivish Henoch the hermit possessed holy powers. From this time onwards, people in trouble tried to find some way of doing something for the hermit, so that they in turn might be helped as a result. Thus it was that when the wife of Zundel Moshe wanted a cure for her childlessness, she called together all the other childless wives in the town and suggested that they start a fund for building a Beis HaMedrash with special accommodation for Feivish Henoch the hermit, and to call the Beis HaMedrash by his name. And that is the story of the Beis HaMedrash called the Synagogue of the Old Hermit. It is an interesting fact that after this, all these childless wives bore children. A certain Avraham Moshe then became the shamash there, but refused to accept any payment. This is the same Avraham Moshe whom Shmuel Nochem found there when he arrived in Dubrovna. But Chaim the hermit, whom he also found at the same Beis HaMedrash, had no connection whatsoever with the hermit Feivish Henoch, after whom the Beis HaMedrash had been named. The two stories told, one by Yitzchok Shol, which we told earlier, and the other by Shmuel Nochem, made an enormous impression upon the listeners in the Smith's house. The moral lesson they could learn from them stood out clearly. They could also see a difference in the characters represented. Yitzchok Shol's story of the reformation of Lippe Boruch demonstrated clearly the great good that was achieved through the influence of the Baal Shem Tov. Shmuel Nochem's story, on the other hand, stressed the holiness of the Porsche, Feivish Henoch the hermit. Moshe Leib wanted to know if the Baal Shem Tov would approve of anyone becoming a hermit, to which Yitzchok Shol replied, "Definitely not." And Shmuel Nochem confirmed this by quoting a saying of Rabbi Odom Baal Shem, that the difference between a Nister, a hidden tzaddik, and a Porsche, a hermit, is that while a Nister chooses to hide his identity and scholarship by mixing among the people as a simple Jew, the Porush separates himself from everybody and stands out as an individual which has the making of conceit. The former earns the love and admiration of the Almighty, while the latter calls for the admiration of his fellows. No, the role of a Porush is certainly not the way of a Chosid, he said. By now, Moshe Leib had become fascinated by Yitzchok Shol's stories of Hasidim and their way of life, recounted in such an interesting and dramatic manner. Meshe Leib reminded Yitzchak Shaul that he had omitted to complete a story which he had just touched upon, namely the one about Chaim Shmuel. He reminded Yitzchak Shaul that according to the direction of the Baal Shem Tov, Chaim Shmuel was to be befriended by Avram Mendel and be made a chassid. At this point, the story was interrupted. "Yes, do tell us what happened," chorused the others. And this is the story that Yitzchak Shaul now resumed. Chaim Shmuel was at a very early age left without parental care. His father, Getzel Shlema, was a pauper who went around begging from door to door. If anyone had pity on him and gave him something, he would, by way of thanks, say, Shema Yisrael. If, on the other hand, he received nothing, he also said Shema Yisrael. On occasion, when he was seen in the Beis HaMedrash, all he was heard to murmur was again Shema Yisrael. So naturally enough, people regarded him as a halfwit, and they were too busy with their own affairs and troubles to worry about Getzel Shlema's little sons. When Chaim Shmuel was almost due to become bar mitzvah, a teacher in town took pity on him and took him in and taught him how to read Ivrah, how to read the Hebrew, and to put on tefillin and say the brachas. But this certainly did not make it Talmud Chochem, a scholar, out of him. When he became 14 years of age, the poor, neglected child decided he would leave Harki and see if his fortunes would improve. He wandered through towns and villages, taking whatever work came to his hand to provide him with something to eat. Sometimes he hired himself out as a shepherd boy, at other times he worked in the fields or gardens. Mostly his work was temporary, but somehow he managed to make his living. Thus 10 years passed, and this lonely lad developed into a handsome young man, yet without what one could call a future, for he had no one who would take any interest in him and his welfare. Many were the temptations that beset his path, and while he felt responsible to no individual, an inner fineness kept him honest and upright. When he was 25 years of age, without ties of any kind, he decided to hire himself out as a shepherd in a Jewish settlement. At that time, he barely could read Ivrah, but he had such a yearning for things Jewish that he struggled bravely to read a little Chumash or Tillim so that he could give expression to the Judaism that filled his heart. And thus the years passed uneventfully by. In the summer he looked after the cattle, and in the winter he undertook all sorts of heavy tasks. But whatever he did and wherever he went, he was the victim of an inferiority complex because of his lack of education. Chaim Shmuel was close to 30 years of age when he married the daughter of a local settler. He settled in the same village as his father-in-law and just about managed to earn sufficient to keep himself and his wife alive. Meanwhile, his father, Getzel Shlema, continued as of old, begging from door to door and still only speaking the phrase Shema Yisrael. This continued for the rest of his days. When Getzel Shlema felt that he was nearing his end, he called one of the local grave diggers to him and said to him, "I would like you to inform the Gabbai, the warden of the Chevr Kadisha, the burial society, that my last request is that I should be buried in the worst part of the cemetery. I only ask that I should be buried in the beginning of a new row." He then gave the grave digger a basket, which he asked should be buried with him. "I'm sorry to say I have no money to pay you for my burial, and so I've tried at least to be as little trouble to you as possible. In the corner of the room you will find a barrel of water, so you should not have to bother bringing any for my tahada, my purification, that which is done for a person that has passed away." The gravedigger looked, and true enough, the barrel stood where the dying man had indicated. The shamus hurried off to his friends, the other gravediggers, full of mirth at what he considered a huge joke. "What do you think, my friends? Getzel Shlema has actually requested that he be given the worst part of the cemetery as his burial place, as if he had any choice in the matter. He would in any case get the worst. But mark you, he wants to be the first in a row of graves. Well, all I can say is that it will have to be a row of maniacs." As they all joined in the laughter, the first gravedigger showed his friends a basket which Getzel Shlema had asked should be buried with him in his grave. They all looked at it curiously, wondering what it contained. One of them shook it and said, "It's not empty. Let's look inside and see what it contains." They opened it and saw some manuscripts there. "Maybe it is a literary work that Getzel Shlema has written," one of them said laughingly. "We really ought to go back and see if he doesn't forget to say Shema Yisrael after all," he roared at his own witticism. When they returned to Getzel Shlema's room, they found the dying man at his last. And to their great astonishment, he was saying vidui with eyes closed. This man, whom no one had considered capable of saying more than Shema Yisrael, how could it be possible? A few few moments later, Getzel Slim drew his last breath. The Rav of Harkiv, Nachum Yitzchok, always made it a practice to attend all funerals, whether of important or unimportant Jews. And so when he heard of the death of poor Getzel Slim, he asked that he be given notice of the time of the funeral. When he arrived at the funeral, the sexton, who was given the basket with the manuscripts or documents or whatever they were, came up to Rav Nachman Yitzchok and told him that Getzel Slim had given this to him before dying and had asked him that it be buried with him. The sexton wanted the Rav's confirmation that it would be in order to do as the dying man had requested. Rav Nachman Yitzchok took the basket with the papers and examined it, and was totally astonished by what he had found. But what was it that he had found? Yirtzeh Hashem, in the next installment, as we continue the tales of how Rav Baruch became a chassid.